This is the Cloud Ace Podcast, bringing you the latest in cloud security through captivating chats with fascinating cybersecurity experts who are leaving their mark on the industry. Cloud Ace is brought to you by the SANS Institute and hosted by SANS fellow Frank Kim. And now, prepare for departure. We're cleared for takeoff. Here's your captain, Frank Kim.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Cloud Ace Podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have on the show with us Fred Brett Mounet, who is the CISO at Clarify Health Solutions. Fred, thank you so much for joining.
Hey, how's it going, Kim? No, Frank, sorry.
Well, Fred, hey, no better way to start the podcast here than with a little bit of a verbal typo here. All right. Well, hey, like we like to do on this show, you know, I want to start with a little bit of personal history. Now, hey, you're originally from, your family is French, so originally from France, but from, as I understand it, you lived in a number of different places and also grew up in Africa. Can you tell us a little bit about that history and how that wound up coming to be?
So I'm French and very proud of being French. But yes, I was born in Ghana and raised in Ghana and Nigeria, English-speaking countries. That's why I unfortunately don't have a thick French accent, which I could have used when I was single for sure. I truly believe my upbringing is why I am in cybersecurity today. It forced me to be self-reliant, to be curious, and to fix things, which is the beginning of understanding how things work.
Very interesting. I was pausing for a sec because I thought you were going to keep on going. But tell us, what's an example of how you had to be self-reliant as a kid in that environment growing up?
Actually, a funny story comes to mind. So we would go back to Europe once a year in the summer for vacation and also to replenish in the mission critical stuff. And one year, I remember my parents having a suitcase full of shoes for me and my brother for the year, because you couldn't buy shoes locally, so you had to bring your shoes with you. Turns out that suitcase never made it. I remember us going to the market and trying to find some shoes, which were probably rejects from Nike or some other manufacturer. And I ended up with two left shoes because we forgot to check. And so that year, I was in flip-flops most of the year. I remember having a bicycle, which was hard to find in Nigeria. So we had brought it back. It was one of those mountain bikes. I brought it back from Europe. And I quickly broke it, of course, being a kid. And I had to figure out how to disassemble and reassemble my bicycle to fix it. So yes, I had lots of toys that were disassembled and never made it back to the reassembled phase. But in the process, I learned a lot. I learned how to fix stuff, electronics, and mechanical items too, because we didn't have access to most of the Western world's conveniences. And so if we couldn't fix it ourselves, we didn't have it.
Now, before I go on and ask you, you know, kind of, hey, the security origin story, the foundations were laid here with, you know, this background that you had as a kid, you know, why, you know, what was your family doing in Ghana?
My dad was working for a French company similar to the West Indies colonial times, except that it was the French version. He started working for that company in Ivory Coast, which is an ex-French colony. And then got promoted through the ranks and gradually went east, across the West African line of countries. That was the standard promotion path for French expatriates in that company.
Ah, okay.
Very. So nothing of my doing. I was just the little pawn that you moved around with the family.
So as this was all happening, you mentioned not necessarily having some of those modern conveniences. Then how did you get introduced to your first computers?
Oh, I'll have to share a picture of me and my first computer. Actually, another happy event because in the 80s, when our first computer got introduced to the household, it was the craze for the Apple, the Ataris, and the Commodores and whatnot, which were the typical household computers at that time. And my dad decided to go for something a lot more obscure, an Osborne 1.
Mm-hmm.
That was a CPM-based computer with actually four or five pieces of software bundled into it. And actually, that's what convinced him to buy that, because it had a word processor, a spreadsheet, and some other things. It didn't have games. For a, what was I, 13, 14-year-old, that was really bad news, because I was not interested in a spreadsheet. I was much more interested in games. And so I had to learn BASIC. And learning to code in BASIC was done by copying all of those printouts in those magazines, because at that time, that was the way you shared programs, was through magazines. And of course, the typo would insert itself, and I would spend hours trying to figure out why it was not working for me. And so that really is the reason why I became so fascinated by computers, and why I didn't become just a gamer, because I'm lazy just like everybody else, and I would have taken the path of least resistance if I had it.
Very cool. Now, did you also play those ASCII art games back then?
Oh my God. Yes. And so the Osborne 1 had a very interesting feature. It was one of the first portable computers. It was the size of a sewing machine. Of course, it didn't have any batteries or anything, but the screen was the screen of an oscilloscope. So it was, what, 5 inches by 5 inches. And it was a virtual screen on a larger display. So you could only see a quarter of your screen at a time. And it was purely text. And we had a, what's the precursor to the dot matrix? The daisy wheel. We had a daisy wheel printer. And I printed so much ASCII art. And of course, being a young boy, there was some racy ASCII art, if you can call it racy by today's standards.
That's too funny. All right. Well, hey, we'll just leave it at that. So, hey. So you're in Ghana, you know, hey, you're kind of coming of age here. And then what happens next? Where do you go next?
So actually, I was in Nigeria going to a, when I think about it, I have a slightly unique background. I did school by mail before the internet. So all of my middle school was done via snail mail. My teachers were in France, and it would take me 3 months to get my homework corrected. I can tell you that that feedback loop doesn't work very well. And so when it came time to go into high school, my parents made the wise decision of sending me and my brother to boarding school. So I went back to Paris spent 2 years. Yeah, 2 years in boarding school. Actually, a fascinating one. It was a chateau from the 18th century. That was my boarding school. It was beautiful.
Wow. Hey, but that's both incredible. Not only the school and the setting, but taking school by mail, that just sounds incredible.
School by mail was phenomenal. The internet revolutionized that. But before the internet, it still existed. In France, every French citizen anywhere in the world has access to free French education. So they had to figure it out. And the way they made it was to use teachers who are in permanent or partial disability to teach by mail. And so, yes, I had assigned teachers, and I had a little profile like in your dating profile. I had the little profile of my teachers, and then I knew of them. They would share their stories, but it was all done over snail mail. It was very different.
So you go to this French boarding school and you show up there. Do the other kids make fun of you for not having a French accent?
Yes, at that point, I had a little bit of a British accent speaking in French. I did adapt relatively well because I had been in the French school system for the last 6 or 7 years at least. What I did not adapt very well to was winter. That was my first true winter in Europe. And I still remember the palm of my hands peeling of the lack of humidity the entire winter, because I was used to 99% humidity in West Africa, and that was not the case. I was also seriously disappointed in the lack of postcard-like Christmas colors. I.e., my vision of what winter was in Europe was all white, beautiful snow, and all of the Christmas lights all over the place. Turns out, winter in most cities with snow is more like a gray mess, a dirty mess, and I was very disappointed.
That's right. Hey, so let's fast forward a little bit. You know, I think we both started our careers in the dot-com boom and the bust. And so tell me a little bit about your first job. How did that come to be?
So I ended up finishing college in Stevens Tech in New Jersey, Hoboken. They had made an arrangement with my college in France, where I got a master's in computer science, where you could transfer for the last 9 months and get an American master's, which was very attractive to me. I've always had the vision of going international. It did not really happen, but that was my vision as a young adult. I ended up spending 6 months in Hoboken. I ended my program early and went back to France thinking the American dream was not mine. Hoboken in the winter, without a car, with a wife-to-be stuck in France, a two-year-old kid in France, was not my definition of fun. So I went back to France thinking my American dream was over. I also was part of the last compulsory military service contingent. So I was still due to do my 12 months or 16 months of military service, and I was resigned to doing it. There's a whole story behind that. We can go into it over a beer later. Ultimately, a few weeks before having to report for duty, I got a letter telling me that I had been exempted from military service. I'll just say someone pulled some strings and I benefited from it. So time for me to find my first job. And there was a small ad in my college in France looking for a software developer in Novato in California. Wow, exciting. California, you know, the California dream. While I had crossed San Francisco as a kid, I had never been to San Francisco. So I thought, you know, what an opportunity. We'll try it. And I started writing shrink wrap software for OCR, optical character recognition. So we were bundling software with scanners that was try to read scans and making sense of it. In the 90s, that was quite a feat and absolutely not as good as it is today. So I started my career as a software development. I landed in Novato, a 7-employee company. The guy was French and knew exactly what he was doing because he was explicitly targeting those French graduates from that college that was specialized in computer science. And I think his first offer was $1,200 a month, which back of the napkin calculation sounded really, really not enough. You didn't have the internet at that time to do any comparison or any research. And so I countered telling him, yeah, I'll do it for 15. Turns out I was way under.
Wow. With a wife and kid in tow as well.
So I have fun memories of that time. We didn't have any access to credit. because we didn't have any credit history. So we were cash only. And yes, I remember some last few days of the month having to eat the pasta that was the only thing we had in the kitchen because we were out of cash. But at the same time, it was a simple life. I didn't have to worry about financing, mortgages, or anything like that. So yes, it was tight, but it was maybe healthy.
So you go from there. How long did you work there? Because then shortly thereafter, you go to one of the, I guess, iconic .com consulting agencies. Not security focused. We'll get to that in a moment. But you wind up at Sapien. How did you wind up there?
Sapien. Again, luck of the draw. I have quite a few of those points in time where they were a magical moment for my future, and I didn't even know it. So I joined Sapien, I believe, in 97. I do remember it was 3 months before Sapien went public. And Sapien taught me so much. Sapien was a phenomenal company to take newly graduate kids. I was in my late 20s. I was still a kid at that time. And make consultants out of them. Yeah, sure. We had to wear suit and tie, which made my life easy because it was white shirt. The only choice I had in the morning was what color tie would I pick? So at Sapien, I learned how to interact with customers, how to understand business requirements, which it turns out is one of the reasons I'm successful in cybersecurity, is because I understand the bigger picture than just the security picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined Sapien in 97. As an immigrant, Sapien also turned out to be my green card sponsor, and that has some repercussions down the line. But I ended up spending, I think, 6 years at Sapien. I went all the way up the dot-com boom and all the way down the dot-com bust, which was slow enough that I watched all of my riches vaporize over 6 months or a year. And I also watched most of my colleagues lose their jobs. At the height, I think we were somewhere around 3,000 people. By the time I got laid off, I think we were 1,500 or 1,000. So there had been a lot of thinning of the ranks. And yes, 2001, in March, I got laid off. I got laid off by a really close friend of mine, and I'm still bitter about it because on Sunday, I was at a barbecue with him, and I was telling him about my plans of buying a new minivan, and he sounded wishy-washy about it. And sure enough, the next day, Monday morning, he was the one to call me to tell me that I had not made it through the latest round of layoffs. I still love him to death. But
another key skill you learned early on is reading between the lines.
I was not that good at it at that time. So anyhow, March 2001, the disaster happens. Disaster for quite a few, from quite a few angles. One, single household income. My wife and our kids at that time, I had three kids already. We're all depending on my income. I still remember taking the Golden Gate bus back home that day and wondering if I should stay at work till the end of the day, or what I was going to tell my wife, because the sense of shame was absolutely horrific. And you know, it was my first time getting laid off, so I was taking it very personally. There was also a bigger problem. that was green card employer sponsored. And at that time, I was under the impression that if I didn't have my green card in hand, my sponsorship would end with my employment termination. So on paper, it was time to pack, which was absolutely not our vision for our future and would have been a disaster in my plans. So we looked at our finances and decided we had enough to stick around for 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have to start thinking about going back to France. In those 5 weeks, I find out one of the biggest realizations of my career is that you don't look for a job by posting your resume on Dice or whatever it was at that time. You looked for a job by networking. And believe me, for an introvert, that's a huge thing. But I learned that lesson. And that's exactly how I found my next opportunity. Literally, the only place that was, or nobody was hiring, you know, especially in systems integration consulting, I was a jack of all trades. I didn't have a specialization. Yes, my specialty was helping failing teams. I was the fixer. Sapien was about fixed price, fixed time. That was our delivery model. And so it was really important to identify teams in trouble early and give them the help they needed to get back on track. Otherwise, our bottom line was quickly impacted. So that was my specialty. Get in there, help them out, get them back on track, and then move on to the next project. So anyhow, turns out the lights are out everywhere. Nobody is hiring. I think in those 5 weeks, I had maybe 2 interviews. That was it. One place where the lights were on was the brand new industry called security consulting. Turns out, one of my brilliant moves of my career, which was totally accidental, is that I knocked at the door of a company called AtStake. AtStake was still about 100 employees at that time, still in a relative infancy. And they were hiring like crazy. Week 5 arrived. I had an offer in hand and I was going to start on that Monday, and it was Friday and I still did not have my green card. And I knew that on Monday, my employer was going to ask for proof of right to work. That Friday mail was godsend because it had my temporary green card in it. And that's how I recovered from the dot-com bust. I still remember intensely that first week at AtStake. AtStake gave me a big shot. I did have my CISSP. I was an application developer, and I kind of had some cybersecurity knowledge. But they were really interested in that cross of application security, because even then, that was the unicorn. I still remember my first week at AtStake in our office in San Francisco. The AtStake had a policy that everything was fair game for hacking except for payroll. It makes sense. While I thought of myself as a hacker in the traditional terms of hacking, which is making things do something they're not intended to do, I was certainly not a hacker in the terms of black hat, white hat. And so I still remember that first week. The Wi-Fi didn't exist at that time, so it was Ethernet plugs. And the whole week, I would connect to the network on demand. I needed to refresh Outlook. I would plug in the Ethernet jack. I would refresh Outlook and I would unplug as quickly as I could because I was a sitting duck. And, you know, there were all of those brand names around me. I can remember Mike Schiffman, David Polino, and others like that, that were phenomenal in their skill sets. And I got to learn from them so much. I'm so grateful for that. So that's how I got into cybersecurity. And it was just the luck of the draw, to be honest.
That's an amazing journey. You know, you wind up, you know, go from a web consulting company, Sapien, one of the best known names at the time, to probably what, the iconic security consulting company at stake, from which even today, many security leaders and industry experts that we know of have their roots in at stake. And so you show up the first week at work and you're there for the first month, you know, unplugging from Ethernet. You mentioned you had your CISSP, which was pretty early, but, you already knew some of these people. How did you know them if you weren't in security?
I did not know them. That's the luck of the draw, is I had no idea who at stake was until I was at stake. Then I started realizing how much history there was. Yes, you're right. Those people are thought leaders all across the cybersecurity world today. I am a failure compared to all of them because they're all in top influential. It's just mind-boggling how many legends I've worked with without even realizing it.
Yeah. So you wind up being there for, I think, what, almost 4 years. You know, why did your time there come to an end? What happened? And why did you wind up transitioning?
It's a sad story. I think it was in 2004. There was some consolidation of the cybersecurity world. Large security product vendors were acquiring security consulting firms to give them a little bit more clout in the cyber world instead of just being antiviruses. They wanted to be a one-stop consulting shop. And so I believe McAfee acquired one of our competitors. Symantec decided they couldn't let that be and acquired AtStake. At that point, the San Francisco office was maybe a dozen people. The entire company was maybe 250 people. I certainly knew I was not interested in being one of 60,000. So most of the San Francisco office reached the same conclusion as I did, which was not with me. And most of us ended up quitting. That is how ISEC Partners was created. That was the time when the San Francisco office decided, we'll start an at stake over, but we're not going to be part of Symantec. Unfortunately, that option was not an option for me. I could not afford to go back to the consulting world. I had something unthinkable in today's world. I was traveling to be physically present at customers to do pen testing. Nowadays, rarely do we do that. But I was burnt. Being on the same flight on Monday morning as the people who are on the flight Friday night coming back from Redmond was getting really old. My personal life was taking a toll. And so I decided it was time for me to move on. You remember that guy who fired me? 3 months later, he followed me to at stake. And then I think a few months before I left at stake, he had moved on to a healthcare company that was essentially inventing the web visit. That was our term for the online doctor visit. And so at that time, he talked me into becoming their CISO. And so I moved there. That was an eye-opening experience because as a consultant, I was dead accurate on my findings. I was very proud of the value I was adding. And then suddenly I realized how full of it I was. The goal is absolutely not to build Fort Knox. it is impossible to build Fort Knox. If you do build Fort Knox, you put your company out of business, especially when it's a younger company that is still trying to prove its business value. The focus on security has to be the least intrusive possible, and very balanced, i.e. there's other priorities, like making payroll, not spending on the latest SIEM or whatever. So at Relay, I learned the reality of what it is to be a cybersecurity professional, which is a really very balanced approach. And that's where I re-described my vision of myself as being an evangelist, i.e. I'm that trusted advisor that will help you see something you were not aware of and will help you assess the risk associated to that and decide what to do about it, not just be a cop or build Fort Knox. And so I always go back to the analogy of buying a car. Most of us are capable of buying a car. We have knowledge of what the reputable brands are, what our business needs are. Do we need a two-seater? Do we need a five-seater? Whatever, minivan, in my case, for example. We have an idea of how to evaluate the quality of that vehicle that we're considering, i.e. there's a crash test rating, there is some reviews, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to paying for that, if we know we can pay cash, the answer is easy. We can make that decision. But if we have to go for a more complicated financing option, that's where we're supposed to involve the expert. You call your financial advisor. Hey, should I lease this vehicle? Should I buy it? Should I put a loan on 7 years, 5 years, 2 years? There's so many options. I'm not the expert. I have to rely on the expert to help me build my decision, which is unique to me. And it's not the same as Frank's decision about how he's going to finance his car. And so my role is really that financial advisor that helps you with the intricacies of cybersecurity when it comes to make big decisions. For the simple stuff, I should have taught you that your minimum password is 12 characters and should contain this and that. You're capable of picking the right password, usually.
And that is a lesson that many security people and security leaders don't learn for many, many years. So that's something you picked up relatively early. So getting in the security game early and figuring out that that's the one key lesson learned that every security professional needs to know.
So many of us do ourselves disservice by not having business acumen. Because in a vacuum, our advice is irrelevant. Yeah, telling a company it needs to build Fort Knox when it's actually having a hard time meeting payroll because it's a startup is the worst thing you can do for that company. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in my career, I've seen so many of us be so focused on the technical side of cybersecurity and completely miss the mark on the social side, which is communication, and the business side, which is you're not the only priority a business has. Far from it.
So that experience really started a very long run in healthcare specifically. You know, after that, you wind up at McKesson, and that was a very long stint there. And at McKesson, how'd you wind up there? And how did you see that change in security from when you started to when you left?
So you remember how I quit At Stake because we were acquired by a monster? A few years later, Relay was acquired by the healthcare monster called McKesson.
I didn't realize that, and you still stayed for that long.
I had a little bit more wisdom that told me, hey, check it out before you quit. And it turns out McKesson is really a holding company. Sure, they have corporate security services, they have corporate compliance services, but really things happen at the business unit a lot more. And when McKesson acquired us, they realized, the corporate security department realized that Relay was actually in a relatively good security posture. knock on wood, we had never been compromised. And I knew a little bit of what I was talking about. So we were doing things relatively right, to a point even better than McKesson was at large. When you think about it, a monster like McKesson is really something hard to manage its security posture. There's always weaknesses hiding here and there. It's so hard to have an understanding of the broad security posture of such a large organization. So it turns out McKesson actually offered us something that is what led me to stick around. They were comfortable with us running independent on our security posture and only involving them for things we needed help with. So for example, workstation and corporate security policies and procedures, I was happy to delegate that to them. They had a SOC, they had managed services and whatnot that I could not afford on my own. And so that was theirs. Their idea of having us host in their own data centers, I said no. And we kept our own hosting independent from McKesson. And I was right, because at one point there were some compromises that did not affect us. So that setup worked really well, where I was as independent as I wanted, and apparently as influential as I wanted to be, because at one point McKesson had the concept of distinguished technologist, which was a program where they had half a dozen technologists elected every year for exceptional services to the organization. To this day, I'm the only security guy who was a distinguished technologist at McKesson. Again, going back to business acumen, technical skills, and cybersecurity skills, and my ability to overcome my my introversion and being able to talk semi-intelligently to a crowd. And so that's how I stuck around at McKesson, with a very symbiotic relationship.
Now, towards the end there, was McKesson moving already to the cloud?
McKesson was actively trying to move to the cloud. They had made a large deal with Azure, the other one. And we were in the process of migrating our data center, or exploring the migration of our data center to Azure. By the time I left, unfortunately, McKesson at one point decided to divest of its technology services, and so it resold our business unit to Change Healthcare. And Change Healthcare's corporate cybersecurity strategy was 180 degrees opposite to McKesson's. It was, let's consolidate everything into a centralized service, which I absolutely conceptually disagree with. There is no way a centralized service can understand the details of a business unit and get the, not the authority, but the willingness of a business unit by not being part of them. I.e., me being inside the business unit was a huge advantage to my colleagues being corporate security, imposing something on the business unit. And so that's when I decided it was time for me to move on, because of that strategic difference, which I absolutely and still to this day disagree with. And that's how I started my specialty, which has been for the last 7 years now. I specialize in young startup healthcare technology companies. I am their first CISO, and I get their first security program in place, usually being a one-man show for 3 to 5 years before starting to recruit a team to help augment me.
Now, you've done that for a number of times now. So, you know, it's usually, I always find it very difficult to be the first CISO at any organization, especially a young one, because at any organization, the rest of the leadership team is trying to figure out how to work with security, how to incorporate you into the leadership decisions and so on. And then, especially joining an early stage company, as you said, if you're a single person team, well, then, hey, you've got to roll up your sleeves and actually get stuff done. And, you know, not just be a PowerPoint jockey all of the time. How do you manage all of that?
Actually, getting stuff done is the reward for me. I love getting my hands dirty. I'm still a technologist. I still have an easier time talking Python than I do talking to humans. The last two companies, I think I was lucky that they reached out to me. So there was already a connection between the leaders and I through prior relationships. And there was an understanding that the CISO role was needed. So I don't know if it's luck or if it's me choosing my next venture carefully enough. But in those two cases, I've never had any problem selling my agenda. Actually, at some points, I've actually tried to sell the opposite of my agenda. For example, at Clarify, the company I'm currently at, like a lot of companies, last year was a little bit of a tough year. So we had to do rounds of layoffs, and I bubbled up the idea that maybe it was time to eliminate the role of a CISO, because survival of the company was more important, because I had a program in place that could afford to live for a year or two freewheeling. And so my role was potentially less critical than it used to be when I started and when I introduced the whole program. And to your point about it being a mess when you start, yes, that's the part I love, is that there is so much to do and so much to look at that it can be overwhelming, but I tend to enjoy that.
Let's try to get just a touch technical here. So, you know, you show up at one of these organizations, I presume they're all in the cloud now because they're young companies. And what do you start doing? What's the first thing that you do to improve the cloud security capabilities?
I think there's two things that are the recipe to magic. One is, in both cases, those organizations were interested in becoming HITRUST certified. And even though a long time ago I've poo-pooed HITRUST in its infancy, I must give it credits today. HITRUST is a very balanced approach to cybersecurity, and it has helped me at least get around my blind spots. Remember, I come from application security. I tend to focus a lot more on that if I were left to my own desires. I tend to not like policies, so I would be very weak in the policy front if there was not an overarching framework like HITRUST to ensure that I don't forget of the balanced approach that I need to have. The second ingredient is around identity and access management. In both companies, I have put my eggs in the Okta basket. But that strategy could work with Office 365 or even other centralized identity platforms. The idea is 100% of systems that we have access to need to be in Okta or in your IAM. The reason I say that, I have anecdotal evidence to support that, and I'm sure you've seen that all over the place over your career, is that a system that is not managed by IT or InfoSec ends up having too many broken windows. And I'll pick an example. We use NetSuite. Our financial backbone is in NetSuite. I did not want to have access to NetSuite because there was way too much sensitive data in there that I'd rather not be privy to. So I let finance take care of managing their system and access to their systems for a few years. And then at one point, I had to look into it, and suddenly I saw the list of users in NetSuite, and immediately red flags went all over the place. Ex-employees still had access. Guess what? Everybody was admin, even contractors. You know, because it solves the problem the wrong way, but it solves the problem really quickly by giving everybody admin. That reinforced what I knew already and I should have known better, which was if I don't manage it, it's not going to be managed. And through the use of a centralized access control system, and I'm not talking SAML or SSO because this is still very far from that. We only have a third of our 300 applications are integrated through SAML. But just having that inventory system of who has access to what has proven to be a godsend, because now I report automatically on Confluence the number of licenses that we use for every single product. And I can tell you that some products are assigned to, let's say, 50 people and only 10 have used them in the last 90 days. I know we're over licensed on that product or it's useless. I have phenomenal data to make business decisions with it. It also gives me things, capabilities from a security perspective that are absolutely unachievable in any other world. Termination is a Jira ticket away. HR puts a termination date and time, and within 3 minutes of that time, access is terminated automatically, rain or shine, regardless of if Fred is on PTO or not. Through automation and centralization in Okta, all of that is possible. It's not if you don't have a centralized AIM. The other thing is HITRUST and many frameworks require you to validate that people have access, the appropriate access they need to have to do their job. Guess what? We're 250 employees. I can guarantee you, I can't tell you for 3/4 of the people what their job really means from a daily perspective and what systems they really need to have access to. So I have to do access review every 60 days or so per HITRUST. There is no way I can do it myself. I don't know enough about the business and the details about people to make an educated guess. I built a crowdsourcing framework for that. Every month, I have automation that generates a Jira ticket for every manager and lists what each managee has access to and how it deviates based on a template for their role. So, for example, you have AWS access and it's not in your default role, it will be bolded in your Jira ticket. Hey, this is something you might want to pay attention to. And then the manager has to review and attest. It's 5 minutes for them. And for me, it's free because it's all distributed. I do have to babysit a lot, but that's a different story. That process would have been impossible if I did not have a centralized identity and access management framework, because I would not know where to find who has access to what. It would be so expensive every 60 days to build that. Right now, it's a script that runs for 10 minutes and it generates something like 100 tickets. It knows that every 60 days you need to do it for privileged systems and every 90 days for non-privileged systems. It decides this is the month where I do privileged, this is the month where I do unprivileged, and it generates all the tickets. Because of that Okta system, it understands who's managing who and what roles and titles are, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my last part to my secret sauce. And the reason why I'm a one-man show is that because of my developer background, because of the fact that I know I'm not trustworthy, I'm very flaky like every single human on the planet. So I know if I don't automate it, it's not going to happen. So everything is automated.
Amazing. Foundational capability with a lot of benefits. Very great example. Great example. The hey, before we go on to wrap things up here, I just want to ask you about one other thing here. You know, hey, the buzzword of the year, if you will. I believe Clarify Health has been using AI for some time already. Can you talk a little bit about kind of, hey, what's going on and, you know, the security aspects that you need to think about as products are getting built with AI, Gen AI functionality in them?
Oh, that's a touchy subject. I'm unfortunately not going to be able to go into lots of details, except to say one thing. Just like everybody else, we've been hit by the generative AI avalanche of last year. And just like everybody else, we've had people whip out their credit cards to sign up for ChatGPT. And just like everybody else, cybersecurity found out mostly after the fact, and just like everybody else, was not happy about the privacy policies that were attached to those and the NDAs and MSAs that were attached to them. Actually, funny part, and I'm still not over it, OpenAI refused to talk to us about enterprise licenses unless we were upfront willing to commit to spending $100,000.
Oh, wow.
I understand they had a very good problem, but not very friendly from a business perspective. So yes, we've had to do some catch up. We've normalized the situation as well as we could, but this is not just an AI problem. This is a SaaS model problem, which from a sales perspective, from a business perspective, is really phenomenal. You want your product to be accessible to anybody who has access to a credit card. That way you can bypass all of the procurement processes and get entrenched into an organization before they even know what hit them. From a compliance and security perspective, it's not good, but it does mean it opens up the best door possible for those vendors. And it does mean that once a quarter, I'm looking at NetSuite to understand where we're spending money, because I know that those credit cards will trigger a reimbursement request. And so I look at that data to find out who bypassed the process. Sorry. Because there will always be someone who didn't know or didn't care to know that there was a vendor risk assessment process to be followed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, hey, thanks for sharing that element of the journey there. Oh, no problem. Hey, let's go ahead and wrap things up here. And, you know, as we close out, I'll give you an opportunity to ask a reverso question here. Any question that you would like to ask me before we wrap things up?
Yes. Actually, something that's been worrying me increasingly. How worried are you about what appears to be the trend to hold CISOs personally liable?
Yes, that is very concerning. You know, you're talking about kind of, hey, Tim Brown, what's gone on recently with the SEC charges and so on. And, you know, I haven't spoken to Tim personally, but, you know, this is definitely sending repercussions, of course, throughout the CISO community. And many of us are worried about it. And, you know, for me personally, I just feel personally a little bit lucky that, you know, I've haven't had a sitting CISO role, you know, in terms of kind of running security program for an enterprise and since before all of this actually went down. And if I go and read, when I go and read all of the details of the SEC charges and so on, it really boils down to one thing is that hey, these things were said about the security program and the capabilities, but the evidence shows and the aftermath, after effects of the breach show, according to the SEC charges, that wasn't the case. And really for me, you know, one thing I've tried to do, you know, sometimes more successfully than others, is to really be transparent. And that's what the SEC in my reading is really saying is like, hey, are you saying what you're going to do? Are you doing what you say? And if you can't do what you say, well, tell us about it. And, you know, they're putting more guardrails around that. And, you know, for CISOs, for us as security leaders, it's, in making sure that leadership is upfront. And if there is something that we as a security leader need to take a stand on in the organization, hey, we need to be upfront and say, hey, I'm not comfortable about this thing for these reasons, X, Y, and Z. And here are the corresponding business impacts. And, you know, my simple reading of the SEC charges is they're really just asking for transparency and honesty. Now, this specific case, I don't know all of the details, but on the surface, that's just what they're asking for. And they're saying, hey, and we need to do that now in the 10K and the 8K.
Maybe I have way too dark thoughts, because my reading is not as positive as you've worded it. Yes, I can understand that vision, but I also can see the practical outcome, which is that the CISO is going to become an outcast whose only job is to cover exposed things instead of helping fix things. For example, patch management. The Achilles heel of the online world.
Right.
While we have standards of what is acceptable, what timelines are acceptable to patch things, the reality is I've never seen an organization that could systematically meet those requirements. Systematically, as in hit 100% of the patches that they needed to hit every month. Over and over again. So as my role as a CISO is to try and make sure we improve to get as close to that number as possible. But if things continue down the road of that enforcement, my job is going to be also to be a whistleblower. I.e., hey, we didn't do it and we need to go public about us doing only 90% instead of 100%. And I have a feeling that if things go down the wrong path, the CISO is gradually going to become a whistleblower and going to be excluded from the internal workings of the organization.
I could see that as a downstream effect. Now, I've never had gotten to 100% of...
Yeah, no, I don't believe it's possible.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hey, and just as we know, when the audit happens, when the auditor comes in, it's not so much about having zero critical vulnerabilities. It's more about the process. What is the process for getting to that improvement or working towards that? So, you know, I think that in that particular case, that's going to be, you know, hey, I'm certainly not going to blow the whistle and say, oh, well, we need to, you know, go public and say we're not at 100%. I think because that's, as we said, not achievable. But if there are other strategic decisions, right, that are being made, I think, you know, you could argue that, hey, the CFO would in the past, decades ago, have perhaps some incentives after SOX to maybe cover things up or be the whistleblower. And we don't see that, right? I think we're in a transitionary period for the CISO, that the CISO is now going to be, you know, kind of like following the footsteps of the CFO after SOX.
No, it's a very good point, and maybe I need to look at it from that perspective. There's just a lot of unknown, and as you pointed out, we don't understand the details of those cases enough to understand what people were thinking or what people were expecting of each other. And so there's some amount of speculation. Yes.
But Fred, that's a really, really great question. And with that, we're going to go ahead and end it here on a high note. Fred, thank you so much for joining. That was Fred Bretmunet, everybody.
Frank, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Appreciate it. Yep.